College, Wisconsin. Ms. Zylstra.
May it please the Court, my name is Sarah Zylstra. I'm here representing the plaintiff appellants and the cross appellees, which are Colby & Colby Millwork and Colby & Colby Health and Welfare Benefit Plan. Colby Millwork is located in Wausau, Wisconsin. It's a manufacturer of windows and doors, and it has approximately 1,100 employees. It sponsors...
1,100? Pardon, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It has approximately 1,100 employees. It is Colby Millwork is the plan administrator for the Health and Welfare Benefit Plan, and it sponsors the plan for its eligible dependents and employees. Now, before I jump into the contract arguments that are before this court, I would like to mention one thing that I do not want lost in the fray of the oral argument with this court, and that is that plaintiffs, defendants, the district court all agree on one thing, and it's a very important point. We all agree that these contracts at issue require refunds in certain circumstances. The three
of
us.
Well, instead of asking the court to enforce a refund provision that doesn't exist, why not just ask for damages in the amount you paid for KG's treatment?
Well, that is, in essence, what the refund, we talk about it in terms of refund, it is the remedy for the breach. And whether you call it damages or whether you call it a refund, it is, in essence, the same thing in terms of practicality. But the defendants themselves concede that they are contractually obligated to provide a refund, to return the overpayment.
Well, of course, if they, yes, yes, true. But I don't see where you get a contractual obligation to a refund because you made a mistake, right? Colby makes a mistake. They think this child is insured, and he isn't. So and now they say, oh, I made a mistake. The hospital has to reimburse me for my mistake. That's an odd breach of contract theory.
Colby made no mistake, Your Honor. This is not a mistake case. It never has been. When Colby made the payments, it made the payments not knowing whether there was coverage or not, because...
That's a mistake. It doesn't...
And not under the law, Your Honor.
What do you mean? It's a mistake. They think someone is insured and not insured.
I'm not
saying it's culpable or anything. It's a mistake. It's an error.
I disagree, Your Honor, respectfully. The issue with the mistake is at the time that you make it, you're not realizing what the consequences
are. It's a mistake. Of course it's a mistake. That's the English language, you know.
Well, Your Honor, what I would say is this. When Colby made the payments, what we proposed as a fact on summary judgment below, which the defendants admitted, was Colby had indicated, had they known that these providers would not honor a refund request, they wouldn't have made the payment until they made the ultimate determination on coverage. The reason why they made the payment when they did was because of the prompt payment provisions and because of the industry trade and custom with respect to refunds.
But that's just saying they made a mistake, but because of what you argue is an industry custom somehow incorporated in the contract, they can shift the cost of the mistake to the hospital.
No, Your Honor. What defendants admit is had Colby not paid, had Colby waited to pay until a determination of coverage had been made, what would have occurred? The defendants would have billed Medicaid for the services provided to KG, and they would have received payment from Medicaid. This isn't an instance where the providers aren't going to receive payment from who they should have received payment for this child.
That's a different point. That's a different point. But anyway, with regard to your breach of contract claim, I don't understand why we should be speculating about industry custom. These are obviously your client and the hospitals and their sophisticated entities, if they want to have the kind of right of refund you're arguing, why don't they, you know, put it in the contract?
Well, I will tell you, Your Honor, under defendants' arguments, especially with respect to preemption, even if they put it in the contract, they would never, if there was a dispute with regard to eligibility, it would never be heard. Their argument on preemption is that if eligibility is that issue, this court never gets
it. We're just talking about breach of contract. And I'm troubled by the notion that we should interpolate an obligation into a contract on the basis of what you call industry custom.
You're not interpolating, in my mind, Your Honor. The provision of the contract that is at issue is provide covered services, a defined term, to beneficiaries, a defined term, for allowable charges, also a defined term. The term beneficiary is defined as a person eligible to have their health care expenses paid by the plan.
There's no obligation to make refunds.
Well, that's the remedy for the breach, Your Honor. They did not provide covered services to a beneficiary. They provided non-covered services to a non-beneficiary. The question, what they have contended throughout this litigation, is that when they provided services to KG, that somehow they were acting outside the scope of these agreements when they did so. That cannot be for several reasons.
Well, you've lost me completely.
Okay, Your Honor.
What is the significance? Now, what is the significance of the industry custom?
The industry custom, to the extent that the contract is ambiguous on whether or not the remedy for the breach is a refund, and whether that, to the extent that those provisions are ambiguous, the industry custom and the defendant's own recall refund practices and protocols provide the clarity with respect to that ambiguous contract. Farnsworth, many other of the treatises and sources explain that when parties operate in an industry that has these customs and these uses of a trade, they contract with the expectation that those continue in force unless the contract says the opposite. Because these defendants provide 30,000 refunds a year for these exact circumstances, the parties, when they're entering into these contracts, expect that custom to be in play unless the contract says the opposite.
All sorts of retail stores will provide refunds. You bought a product, it's not defective. Take it home, you don't like it. You take it back to the store, they give you a refund because you're a good customer and they want, you know, customer goodwill, so they give you refunds. But they don't want to be obligated. And if your position prevailed, these hospitals would immediately make clear in their contract no refunds, right? They just stop making refunds.
No, Your Honor, for several reasons. I'll start first with your example with respect to retail. I would suggest, Your Honor, that actually there is likely a refund practice in retail, although I haven't looked at that issue specifically. I do know that when I buy, for example, shoes, one of the things I look is whether it's a final sale. If it's a final sale, I know I can't return them. And oftentimes the retail industry will indicate whether something is a final sale, non-returnable versus not. I don't think that's that issue here. I think really the issue that you're getting at is whether the refund practice actually benefits the hospitals. While the defendants in this case are arguing for this specific non-refund because it benefits them in this instance, if you look at the industry as a whole, the refund practice benefits all.
Why isn't it in the contract? If it's so
beneficial? Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, it is. By the terms covered services, beneficiaries allow a charge.
There's no mention about refunds when the benefit plan doesn't. Makes a mistake and submits a request for someone who isn't actually entitled to it.
The terms are binary in the industry, Your Honor. Either you're a beneficiary or you're not. Either the services are covered or they're not. It's a yes-no binary determination. So they're promised to provide this.
The child wasn't a beneficiary.
Correct. So in my mind, Your Honor, that the contract that indicates that those binary terms that they will provide them includes the opposite premise, that they will not provide non-covered services, that they will not provide services to non-beneficiary, that they will not provide services for different charges than those that are the allowable charges. Those are binary terms in the industry.
Well, if they provide services because they've gotten mistaken information from the benefit plan.
No, Your Honor. They never got information from the benefit plan that this child was covered. That is not in this record, and that is not the case. They got no information. What they got were disclaimers from...
Why would they expect Colby to be submitting non-beneficiaries?
Your Honor, they provided services to this child before the father even applied for health insurance with Colby. This is not a case where, and there are cases where medical providers wouldn't provide services but for the fact that someone is covered. And in those instances, those tend to be cases where the providers contact the plan, they get a specific determination as to an individual of coverage, they indicate that they're not going to provide services unless the person is covered. If they get that assurance, they provide the services, and to the extent that there is a determination later of non-coverage, the provider has a misrepresentation claim against the plan. That's not this case at all. Colby made no representations that she was covered. They made no representations one way or the other. And they provided services before the father ever applied. They indicate there's no reliance here. They indicate they would have provided coverage and would have provided services to this child regardless of whether she was covered by Colby or not.
Whose idea was it to take the child to one of these medical college hospitals?
I don't know if it was the medical or the father. The child was born with very serious heart problems. I believe that she was airlifted to the children's hospital, but I'm a little unclear. She didn't start off at that hospital the first day. I think she was born at Marshfield Clinic.
So you're saying Colby had nothing to do with the child's being sent to one of the medical college's hospitals?
Correct. It, from what I understand, Your Honor, I'm not sure that's in the record, but that's my understanding. But
didn't Colby provide a card identifying the child as a plan covered individual?
But the card, there is an insurance card issue with respect to UMR issuing the card. The card does not establish coverage. And I will indicate to you, nothing clearer shows that than Biondi, the case from the circuit, where people often have cards with respect to their medical information, and they may no longer be covered by a plan for one reason or another. So the card isn't an indication of coverage. What Colby has indicated and what is of record of the facts below is the card were to make sure that the invoices and things went to the third-party administrator. In the event that she was covered, it would make the processing of those claims much easier or whatnot. But the card itself was not a determination of coverage.
What is the evidence that there's this established industry practice of refunds?
Well, there's several pieces of evidence in the record. One is the defendant's own practices and protocols. Medical College of Wisconsin provides over 30,000 refunds a year. We put in the record numerous instances of refunds they've given, including, Your Honor, these defendants have provided refunds to two other entities under this contract. That's in the record. So it's not just Colby. There are other entities that are part of these contracts. They provided refunds under these contracts to those entities.
How many of the refunds are similar to this case? That is where, I mean, obviously they'd provide refunds if they had done something wrong, but...
They've provided refunds when plans have later told them that a patient was ineligible for coverage. So they have provided refunds in the exact situation that's occurred here. They've provided refunds when plans have requested 10 months, 12 months.
How large are those refunds?
Your Honor, I know that one of the refunds was for $250,000 for an ineligible patient that was provided to a plan that requested a refund for that ineligible patient that had paid. So I think the circumstances are such that they provide these refunds, and Colby had an expectation that such a refund would be provided. I think it comes back to whether this contract is ambiguous or not. I don't...
What?
Ambiguous? If it's ambiguous, the court has to consider the extrinsic evidence.
What's the ambiguity?
Your Honor, to be truthful, I think that there's no ambiguity because I think it provides for a refund because covered services, beneficiaries...
Well, you said the contract was ambiguous.
Well, Your Honor, because the district court, the defendants, and the plaintiffs have all admitted that refunds are a remedy for breach of this contract in different circumstances. The three of us do not agree on what circumstances those refunds are due. I think that shows ambiguity when you have three reasonable parties taking a different view of the same phrase of the contract. There's also an additional phrase of the contract that indicates that they
you're
will bill.
That the medical college admits that it broke the contract and is just arguing over the remedy?
No, Your Honor. What they admit is that they would owe a refund if they charged more than the allowable charges under the contract. We indicate they did that because the allowable charges under the contract for a non-beneficiary is zero. They can't charge us anything for a non-beneficiary, and they did. So therefore, in my mind, even they agree they owe a refund in that situation. That's a situation that occurred here, and a refund is the remedy for that breach.
Ms. Ilcher, what of the factual setting where Colby, over numerous times, kept making inquiry, seeking information?
Correct, right? Your Honor.
Right. So
up until the day of denial, they put a post-it on the actual denial asking for...
Yeah, you kept asking for it. Now, are you responsible at all for what transpired? The services were being rendered all during that time that Colby was regularly questioning coverage. I mean, did Colby in any way lead the hospital into some false sense of coverage, perhaps?
No, Your Honor. I will say this. I think this is a trap that the district court fell into, and I believe that the defendants have made some sort of argument. There was no reliance here. There was no the defendants were not providing these services to KG because there was coverage for Colby. They admit they would have provided them regardless of whether there was coverage or not. They admit if Colby did not pay anything but took the entire time to decide coverage, they would have billed Medicaid and would have received payment for Medicaid, and they can do so now. If they're ordered to provide a refund in this case, they can turn around and bill Medicaid for KG services and would have received it. That would put the parties in the exact position they should be in and would have been in, but for the litigation in this case.
Medicaid would reimburse the entire amount.
Well, the Medicaid, there is an administrative code provision, and it's cited in the brief, but it indicates that if an insurer recoups payment for services for any reason, that the medical provider can turn around and bill Medicaid for those services if they do it within so
Medicaid
many days.
Medicaid has all sorts of limits on how much it pays.
Sure.
So how do you know? What makes you think they'd reimburse the entirety of the expense?
Well, they'll reimburse the services as Medicaid determines the value of those services
are. No. Medicaid has all sorts of limits. What if they decide, you know, they're going to pay $10,000?
But that's what the parties would have been in had Colby not promptly paid. And the providers
that's
benefit.
That's a separate point.
Okay. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm missing your...
Well, your argument is that they would be made whole by Medicaid.
Correct.
But you don't know what the limits that Medicaid would impose in such a case.
I don't, and that's
so
not...
So you don't know that they'd be made whole.
No, but, Your Honor, the same proposition could be said with any secondary payer, whether it be Medicaid, whether it be Medicare, whether it be a coordination of benefits, the mother's health plan, the father's...
On their contractual obligation, too.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, your argument would be stronger if they really had a secure alternative source of reimbursement.
Why?
Why?
Yes, Your Honor. Because
it's what you just said.
No,
you
Your
said,
Honor.
Oh, they'd be fine. They'd get it all back from Medicaid.
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is the parties would have been...
So Medicaid is irrelevant, all right? So forget about Medicaid. What do you think is the relevance of Medicaid?
The relevance of Medicaid, Your Honor, is only to show, to the extent that they're arguing that they suffer a loss, if you will, from this... Personally, I don't think that's relevant to the breach of contract issue.
Yes, I know, but you can't say they didn't suffer a loss if you don't know how much Medicaid would reimburse.
But a loss presupposes that they wouldn't have been in this position.
That's a separate point.
Okay, Your Honor.
You brought in Medicaid as if it somehow was germane to the case.
It was to the...
It's not germane if we don't have any idea what they would reimburse.
It's germane to the extent that there's arguments in this case being made about reliance, which I believe reliance is irrelevant
course,
to the contract.
But if Medicaid is as chintzy as everybody says it is, then forget about Medicaid, right?
Well, to the extent that reliance is off the table too, then yes, I agree it's irrelevant. But there have been arguments of reliance. The district court, I was responding to Judge Flum's comments with regard to being paying during a time period and whether or not there was any kind of rationale with respect to that.
And following up on what Judge Flom's question, the court really didn't address a waiver by estoppel theory, but here arguably, and the court didn't address this theory, Colby waived its right to enforce the contract by taking certain actions.
No, Your Honor.
Because of the payment and the issuance of the card and that.
And I'd like to address that argument directly. No, Your Honor, this is not a waiver case for several reasons. One, first of all, defendants have not argued waiver, and so the waiver law was never presented, so that's not the argument there. Second of all, Your Honor, I don't believe plans can waive eligibility. With respect to, I'm not aware of any cases, they've cited no cases that plans can. There's certainly law in ERISA that you can't make oral modifications to plans. Plans have to be enforced based on their terms as written. And then keep in mind what waiver is. Take a step back to the general principles of waiver. It's an intentional relinquishment of a known right. Colby didn't intentionally relinquish its right to make a coverage determination. It took 17 inquiries. Keep asking Mr. Kaczynski, including the day it denied coverage, it asks again for additional information. They're trying to make that determination. That is not the actions of someone who is waiving its eligibility right. And they're doing this in an industry where Colby received refunds from 12 other health care providers that provided services to KG. They've received refunds.
Okay. Your time is up.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Noyes?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Respondents, cross-appellants, Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, and the Medical College of Wisconsin respectfully request that this Court affirm the District Court's dismissal of plaintiff's breach of contract claims and reverse and remand the denial of defendant's Rule 11 motion for sanctions. With regard to the breach of contract claims, the District Court properly dismissed those claims because defendants did not breach the parties' contracts. The issue here is not what a proper remedy is, but whether defendants breached. The plaintiffs claim that defendants breached the contracts by refusing to refund payments made on behalf of KG, who they claim was not eligible under their plan. However, as the District Court properly found, the contract is silent as to this situation. It does not mention refunds, and it does not address a situation where a payer retroactively decides that a patient is not eligible. The silence makes sense given the limited nature of these contracts. These are network provider agreements between the defendant medical providers and a network administrator who sets up a network of payers who receive discounted payment terms in exchange for a volume of claims and prompt payment. The plaintiffs here are not parties to these contracts, but only third-party beneficiaries. Because of the nature of these contracts, they assume that the services being provided are covered and that the patients are beneficiaries. If the patient is not a beneficiary, if they are not covered by the payer's plan, the contracts simply do not apply.
Well, Ms. Dixter says that there's such a consistent practice of refunds that it ought to be considered an implicit term of the contract. That's her basic argument.
It is, Your Honor. And we believe, first of all, that you can't get there because these contracts are not ambiguous. Under Wisconsin law, you can't consider usage of trade unless there's an ambiguity. There's no ambiguity here. There's silence. And this is not a situation where the silence creates an ambiguity because these contracts are complete on their face. The medical providers and the network administrators can fully perform these contracts without such a refund provision, and the payers can too. Under the payers' plans, under ERISA, and under these contracts, they can deny claims.
Ms. Dixter, say you always make the refunds, except in this case where it was so much money.
And that's not true, Your Honor. The record does not show that defendants always give refunds. Defendants frequently deny refund requests. That is in the record. And also, defendants here give refunds where there are situations where they might have contractual, tort, or equitable liability. The record shows that most often occurs where there's been a double payment, where a payer has paid more than the contractual rate under the plan, and those situations there's a credit balance in the account. Refunds are also given in cases where there's really small amounts asked for. In those instances, it's an administrative convenience. It doesn't make sense to fight with a payer who these defendants want to keep a good relationship with to fight over these small amounts of money. That's not the situation here. That's not what happened. We're talking about $1.67 million that plaintiffs paid after they told the defendants that KG was covered under the plan, after defendants obtained pre-certification of these services from plaintiff's agent and provided life-saving care to KG. There just has been no breach of contract here.
What about Ms. Zistra's argument, Ms. Zistra's argument that that your client was stuck with the child and would have had to treat her and then might have gotten something from Medicaid, but that would be all?
Well, defendants here, they are charitable organizations. They do provide care without going to the ability to pay. But that's irrelevant to this contract. There is no breach of contract here. Because they just haven't shown a breach. So this information about, well, defendants would have provided the care anyway, you can't even look at that information. It doesn't matter. And frankly, under plaintiff's theory, it wouldn't matter if there was Medicaid or if there was any alternative source of payment. That doesn't matter to what plaintiffs are arguing. Defendants here would be liable even if there was no other alternative source of payment, even if we had to go after KG's dad for this $1.67 million. The Medicaid, as you said in your argument with Ms. Zistra, or your conversation with Ms. Zistra, is irrelevant in this case. And I think the real issue here is plaintiffs are complaining that it's unfair that defendants have given refunds in other situations and didn't give the refund here. But this is a breach of contract case. This is summary judgment on breach of contract. There is no remedy without a wrong. And plaintiffs have not shown any breach of contract. They haven't raised an issue of fact as to any breach of contract here. And for that reason, the district court was correct in dismissing those claims, and that should be affirmed. I'd like to briefly speak about our alternative grounds for affirmance and the basis for our Rule 11 motion, which is ERISA preemption. I recognize that we are in front of two members of the same panel who issued the last decision, and so I will be brief in these remarks. One thing that I did want to state is that the district court, in making its decision, said that defendants were arguing that this court was wrong and were asking for reconsideration of this court's opinion. That's not correct. Defendants believe this court was entirely correct on a motion to dismiss to find that ERISA did not preempt plaintiff's claims because this court was accepting the facts pled in plaintiff's complaint as true for purposes of the motion to dismiss and saying if those facts were true, then plan interpretation and application were not required. Now it's a motion to dismiss. Now it's a summary judgment. The factual premise of plaintiff's claims is that KG was not a beneficiary. She was not covered under the plan. Plaintiffs have the burden of making that proof on summary judgment, and they cannot do so without plan interpretation and application. The district court believed that this court's prior opinion foreclosed it from considering defendant's ERISA preemption argument. We believe that was an abuse of discretion based on a misreading of this court's opinion, and for that reason, we would like this court to remand the Rule 11 consideration for reconsideration by the district court.
So normally with Rule 11, it's when there's basically no basis for the legal argument, and you spent 50 pages briefing this issue. You know, I'm having a hard time understanding why you want us to deem this as frivolous.
Well, and defendant's position is that the district court did not consider our arguments under Rule 11 and that the case should be remanded for the district court to consider our arguments under Rule 11, not necessarily that this court should make a finding that it is frivolous. We do believe this court's earlier decision is clear in that it was relying on facts alleged in the complaint for a motion to dismiss and that it was not reaching a conclusion of law based on unproven allegations as to KG's eligibility. We do believe that that is frivolous, but we also believe the district court would be the best one to look at that issue in the first instance.
Is there any trade literature or academic literature, anything that discusses the practice of refunds in this industry?
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor. I know that there was an amicus brief before this court the first time that addressed that issue, but I am not aware of any. We do believe that the usage of trade here does not there is no usage of trade, we don't think, as to this situation. This just isn't a situation where you can say that refunds are so habitually given, that they're so uniform, that it's such a strong practice that you can say that these defendants intended to be bound to give refunds in these situations. We do not deny that refunds are given in the healthcare industry. We just deny that it shows that there is an intent here, that defendants intended to be contractually bound to give refunds of this sort. Going back to our Rule 11 motion, another basis under our Rule 11 motion was that plaintiff's factual allegations lack evidentiary support. The basis of their factual assertions is that they denied coverage for KG in the first instance, and that's not what the evidence here shows. The evidence here shows that they had their third-party administrator enter information into its computer saying that she was covered. They collected premiums and issued an insurance card with KG's name on it. These are the exact same things that they would do if they had proof of eligibility for a dependent. They did send information to defendants saying that KG was covered. KG was taken to Children's Hospital the day that she was born. The day that she was born, her father also called Kolb and said, "I have this daughter. I want her put on the plan." And Kolb took the steps that day to enter her into the computer system to start doing the enrollment process. Ultimately, plaintiffs paid $1.8 million in medical care for KG, all the while saying they denied her benefits. They also received $600,000 in stop-loss insurance benefits under a plan that only provides payments for patients who are eligible for coverage and covered under a plan. And they never issued a denial of benefits here that's consistent with the plan and ERISA. They never told KG that her benefits for these treatment dates were being denied. Instead, they said that her benefits were being retroactively terminated, which of course means that those benefits were in place prior to the retroactive termination. The district court stated that defendants made a forceful argument with regard to these facts, but that it could not consider them because of this court's prior opinion. We believe that that was an error of law and an abuse of discretion by the district court, and again, we would like that issue remanded to the district court for consideration. The reality here is that plaintiffs enrolled KG in the plan, paid for her care, received stop-loss benefits on her behalf, and have spent 4 years trying to ignore those facts or change them and trying to force defendants to repay these claims without showing anything that defendants have done wrong. The district court properly held that plaintiffs have not raised a genuine issue of material fact as to any breach of contracts by the defendants, that there is no legal ground for requiring defendants to return money that was properly paid for life-saving care given to KG. For these reasons, we request that this court affirm the district court's dismissal of plaintiff's breach of contract claims. We also believe ERISA preemption leads to the proper dismissal of these contract claims, and we ask that this court remand the Rule 11 motion for further consideration. Unless the court has any questions, I'm happy to stop there.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Noyes. So, Ms. Zylstra, your time expired, but if you have anything further, we'll listen to you, of course.
Your Honor, I'd just like to stress a couple of things with respect to the Rule 11. The district court, on the factual issues, determined that these issues were close calls on how the court was going to rule on that issue. And both Mars Steels and the U.S. Supreme Court in Cooter suggest that the appellate court and this court and Mars Steel, that it doesn't do a good service for this court to have to wade through the record and determine Rule 11 when a district court has done so. I would urge affirmance on that. With respect to the evidence on usage of trade, UMR put in affidavits on summary judgment. UMR is the largest third-party administrator in the United States. It handles 65 million claims a year. It put in a series of information with regard to the usage of trade in the industry. And despite the fact that defendants contend that they give these refunds and they're small amounts and they don't want to fight, the practices are really not in dispute here. 30,000 refunds a year, and they gave a refund for $250,000 to a plan who determined after they paid that someone was ineligible for coverage. So this is a situation that they deal with, that they've done before, And in terms of the contract, I do believe they're ambiguous and that the court should have considered all of that evidence. The court didn't consider any of it at the district court below. And I'm happy to answer any further questions the court may have.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Extra and Ms. Noyes. And we'll move to our third case.